Hi, my name is Mike, and I'm one of the ministers here at the church. I'd like to start by thanking you for listening to this sermon online. Before we get started, I'd just like to say that we truly hope that this audio recording will encourage you in your walk with God. But we also hope that it would just be supplemental to your relationship with Jesus, and that it would in no way replace the church that you should be plugged into or the spiritual leaders God has put in your life to shepherd you. So please, enjoy the next 30 minutes or so of this message. I pray it will challenge and uplift you wherever you are in your spiritual journey. God bless.
All right, is this on? Okay. It is so good to be here. I shared with you, I think, on the video this past Sunday. This is my first time in Canada. I did get in, so the flight got in at 1:10, but I didn't get to bed till about 2. And so I was a little tired, but then Mike took me, and I am now hopped up on poutine and Saskatoon berry pie. So I am ready to go on Revelation tonight. But it is so good to be here with you, and I'm so thankful that you have given up a Friday night and a Saturday to come and study the book of Revelation with me. I'm really looking forward to our time together. It is a big deal when you invite a stranger in to come to talk about Revelation. Because I have found that at least in the States, the only people who like Revelation are usually weirdos. In fact, the only kind of Revelation joke that I know, a friend of mine named John Young shared this joke with me, but he said, at church, if anybody ever comes up to you at church and says, I want to teach a class on Revelation, never let that person teach a class on Revelation because they're crazy. You know, no one likes Revelation but crazy people. So the fact that you trust me enough to talk about Revelation, thank you so much for bringing me here. There's one disclosure. So this is a workshop that I've done now actually all over the states. I've been out California, Georgia, Kansas, all over the place. This is my first time not to do it in the states. And I want to learn this weekend from you. I had to go through the PowerPoint version back here is the Canada version. Because a lot of the way that I teach this, at least in the States, is relevant for churches in the States, but it's different here. I've been told by someone, if I want to win you over as an audience, I need to talk about our president. I'm just kidding. Just trying to cut the ice there. Just trying to break the ice early. We're going to have fun over the next 2 days. But in all seriousness, I mean, if you're in ministry or you're living down in the States, like, how can you not address the elephant in the room, you know? So it's going to be interesting to teach it here, and I genuinely want to learn from you. So on breaks and stuff, if there are things that strike you as a Canadian, I want to learn that from you. And forgive me if I say things that may not be as relevant to you in your context. So I have to kind of do that on the front end as a little bit of a caveat as we get ready to study. I also have to give credit to where the title for this comes from. Mike Gorman wrote a book called Reading Revelation Responsibly, which is like the best title for a book on Revelation ever, right? And I use this as the textbook in my class at the university to teach students. And everybody's always like, recommend a book. This is the book I'd recommend. I think it's great. And whenever I share that I'm doing one of these workshops, I know Mike Gorman. He's a Facebook friend of mine, and he'll always comment and say, what a neat title you have for your workshop this weekend. And my response to him is always, well, it's not fair that you have a copyright on the best name ever for a workshop on Revelation. But if you want more than what we're able to do, this is one of the books that I would recommend to you. In this first session, what I want us to do is get our wheels spinning and to talk about what Revelation is. Because whenever we come to a book of the Bible, we want to ask, what are we reading and how do we read this book well? And Revelation is a doozy, is it not? It's a doozy of a book. Do you have VeggieTales here in Canada? Did you know that there was an episode of VeggieTales that did not make it to TV? It was the Revelation-themed one. It was too scary. All the vegetables got charred. Here's the rapture. Here's the leftovers. Here's the four horseradishes. Here's the beast and the prostitute. Oh, that didn't make the TV. The fallen angels. the dragons and the prophets, plagues and war, the last judgment, and the New Jerusalem. Can you sort of see why this VeggieTales episode, this is totally fake, this is AI, but isn't this what we think about when we think about Revelation, though? We think about scary things, we think about the end times, we think about judgment, we think about fire. We think about one of the most prominent ways that Revelation's been read and thinking about the rapture and the end times. And so we have all these scary images of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. What about those beasts with the multi-heads? And what do we make of these crazy beast-like creatures that show up in Revelation 13? How about 666? You have to say it like that, right? Okay. I don't know if you have these kinds of things happening here in Canada, but man quits his job when 666 shows up on his tax document from the government. That's a bad sign. And then it turns out he gets a higher paying job, so he was listening to the Lord when he saw 666. One of my favorite stories was we had moved back to Tennessee and I had gone to the DMV to get my license plate for my car. And the lady's like doing her stuff and she picks up a plate from the box and she looks at it and she says, "Oh no, I'm not giving you this one." And I said, "What?" And the first three numbers on the plate were 666. She said, "I'm not going to do that to you." And now I so regret not getting a license plate. Wouldn't that be like the ultimate talking point for a Revelation guy? But this is the way people think about Revelation. The end of days. The end times. Scary predictions about what we're looking for and what's going to happen. And one of the major ways that people have read the book is through the lens of Hal Lindsey's work in the 80s, Late Great Planet Earth, and then the book series that has sold in the tens of millions of copies. Three of the Left Behind books written by Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins have been New York Times bestsellers. And now they've turned them into three films. And I look up here and recognize these actors. I don't know if you do. Kevin Sorbo was Hercules when I was growing up. I don't know if you saw that show. But I recognize, I mean, these are not minor films, in other words. These are major, major films. And in the context in which I grew up in the South in the United States, this is the major way that most evangelical Christians in America are reading the text. And the way that Left Behind reads the text, and if you don't know anything about Left Behind, the way that it uses Revelation and other texts like Daniel and some of the prophets of the Old Testament, is that these are detailed predictions about future events that are to come when the rapture comes and people will be snatched up and planes will fall out of skies and Russia and China and the United States will all be at war with each other and all of these sorts of things. This is the dominant way that most Americans are reading and thinking about the book of Revelation. Maybe you've seen something like this, and I have no idea what this is. I pulled it offline somewhere, but these kinds of detailed timeline charts where people think they can use Revelation to actually go through and predict in a very serious kind of chronological framework, like what's coming, and when stuff starts to happen, you know where you're at on the timeline. These are the ways that many people around the world are reading the book of Revelation. This is a new slide for me because with the conflicts that were happening in Iran just recently, where Iran was shooting rockets over into Israel. Do you remember that just a couple of weeks ago? You know, you have all of these things coming out saying this is prophesied in Revelation 16. This is exactly what you would be expecting to see in the news if this is the kind of thing that Revelation is predicting. This is how most people are reading the book. People have actually died by how they've been reading the book of Revelation. Are you here in Canada familiar with the Branch Davidians and the standoff that happened in Waco? David Koresh said that he was the one who was the God-sent decoder of the seven seals of the scroll in the book of Revelation. And so he was the one who could open the seven seals and bring about the end times. And a group of people gathered around him. And in 1993, the FBI raided the compound. It lasted in a 51-day armed conflict. And more than 80 people died in this, in a fire that was started. So, and this is just one of many instances that we could, that it's important how we interpret the Bible. People have literally lost their lives over how they're reading and interpreting the book of Revelation. There was even a major TV series, I think on Paramount maybe. Yeah, Paramount, on looking at this. And this has to do with how you're reading Revelation. Again, this is one of those where I don't know if it will exactly translate here in Canada, but because most evangelical Christians in America are reading this, this is a huge thing in America. And it really became popularized with the what I call the 1 a.m. TV preachers, the folks that are on TV who are the prophecy experts. And there are millions of Americans who follow these teachers, and they believe that what they're saying is, you know, Revelation's hard to understand. And so these people who are telling me all these complex things, they must be right. And so they're basing so much of what they believe. Well, if a lot of what these people are saying have to do with Iran firing rockets into Israel, then we need our politicians to be aware of what the Bible is predicting about foreign affairs that are going to be happening between nations. Do you see how this kind of works? One of the major folks who has done this is Pat Robertson, who started the 700 Club. If you're familiar with this, it's a famous kind of TV show. And he would go on the 700 Club and say Revelation is predicting these modern kind of events that are happening in the Middle East and elsewhere. And this is Pat Robertson right here. He ran for president of the United States. This is him on the stage debating, and he's standing next to George H.W. Bush. This is Pat Robertson interviewing Ronald Reagan, because no president gets elected in the United States, no, especially no Republican president gets elected in the United States without the stamp of approval of the 700 Club and the right. And so they're talking about these things. In fact, I mean, just to tell you an example from Ronald Reagan, Ronald Reagan, in one of his presidential debates, is talking about Armageddon. If you didn't know this, I mean, this is Revelation in presidential debates in the United States. Here's Al Gore. These are all with Pat Robertson. Here's Pat Robertson with Jeb Bush, another Bush who ran for president. Here's Pat Robertson with Donald Trump. Here's Pat Robertson with Donald Trump. You do not get elected in the United States without talking to Pat Robertson. And what is Pat Robertson talking about? How the book of Revelation predicts the end times through a series of events that are going to happen with wars in the Middle East. You with me? This is a major thing. In fact, when Donald Trump, I love that I'm in this room. Ha ha! Because I usually have to be careful about what I'm going to say. Not in Canada, baby! Okay, here we go. When Donald Trump moved the embassy when he moved it to Jerusalem, the person that he had come and offer the prayer at the embassy was John Hagee, who's one of these left behind folks who's always doing predictions of end times. And this was held as one of the harbingers of the end times, the moving of the embassy to Jerusalem. I mean, this is like, if you don't know this, this is a big deal. And it's important that we get Revelation right. People have died. And then this is a major influence even in global politics right now. So my goal for us this weekend is to read Revelation responsibly. So let me define what I mean by a responsible theological reading of the book of Revelation. The first thing is, and this is a big one, to read anything responsibly. I'm not even just talking about Revelation. Whether we're talking about Matthew or Romans or 1 Peter, whatever we're talking about in the New Testament, to read it responsibly is to read it in its historical context. Now, what we typically like to do, the fancy word for interpreting the Bible in its original context is this fancy word called exegesis. Can you say that with me? Exegesis. That means to draw out the meaning of the text. To say, when Paul wrote this, what did Paul mean to his original audience? And to understand that, we need to study Paul and his original audience so that we can understand what he wrote and how he wrote it. Now, what I like to say is a lot of us don't like to do exegesis. We like to do narcegesis. And that is reading the Bible and asking, what does this mean for me? And we automatically make that jump. But here's one of the principles that I ascribe to. I can't understand what the Bible means to me unless I first understand what it meant to them. And so one of the things that I would say a responsible reading of the text is to say we need to read the Bible according to how it was written to the original audience to whom it was written to. We're going to have a whole session tomorrow morning on reading it as a message to the seven churches of Asia Minor. not reading it as a message straight to the church in Saskatoon. I hate to break the news to you. It was written to seven churches in Asia Minor. And so a responsible reading says, what did John mean when he wrote this for those churches first? Second, it's to pay attention to the whole literary context of the whole book. One of the other things that we like to do sometimes is we like to, and I work with college students, and they want to know, what verse do I get tattooed? You know, I need my tattoo verse. You know, it used to be, for some of you in here, what verse do I have crocheted and hung in my bathroom? You know, but now it's what verse do I get a tattoo of? And so we need that verse. And so many of us in this room, we could say, if I were to poll you, and I'm not going to because I don't want to embarrass us, but what do you know about Revelation right now? And we would pull a few things, like 666. Well, do you have any idea anything else that's going on besides the 666? Do you have anything about how that 666 comment in Revelation 13 may be functioning within the whole of the rest of the book? In other words, this is a highly designed book that has a flow and a structure, and we like to cherry pick things from here and there. A responsible reading says, I'm going to read the whole thing and think of it as a whole document. Then, I actually would say that the last two here, all of the biblical documents, they are written by Christians for Christians for the building up of their faith. And if we just stop at a historical or literary reading and don't ask, what does this mean for us as Christians today, then we're not reading it well either. And so we want to do all these things this weekend. I hope that you have a better idea when you leave this weekend of the historical context of Revelation, of seeing the overall message of the book, and then thinking about what are some lessons that we can take away from as Christians today living. Now, in my Revelation course at York, I have about 1,000 slides that we go through over the semester. I have managed to pare that down to 362. That means you better put your seatbelt on. After the workshop's over, I will share the PowerPoint with Mike, and then he is free to share that with any of you. And so you don't have to feel the need to like take pictures or anything. I'll get it to you if you want it. But we're going to go fast and hard. Because there's a lot, and this is important, and I'm looking forward to our study together. I'll start with my own story with the book of Revelation. I did not grow up in a context that was that left behind, weirdo, obsessed with the book of Revelation. I actually grew up on the complete opposite extreme, where I don't ever remember us ever talking about the book of Revelation. Does anybody in here more relate to that side? In fact, the only thing that I remember us talking about is maybe we would have a sermon series on like the seven churches from Revelation 2 and 3, and we would say, what would Jesus say to us today? That's about it. That was all that I knew. And that's fine. And we're going to talk about tomorrow morning. We've not realized, I don't think, how important those seven messages to those seven churches are for understanding the whole of Revelation. What Jesus does in those messages is he tells those seven churches the things that he's not happy with, and the vision addresses the things that he's not happy with. So if you miss what's happening in those seven messages, you actually don't get the rest of the book. So they're really important. So it's fine that we preach sermons on that. But I didn't ever hear anything. I went to Freed Hardeman University for my undergrad, didn't take a single course in Revelation, even though it was offered. I go and get my master's at Harding School of Theology, and they had a famous professor of Revelation there named Rick Oster. And he had a famous class on Revelation, and I didn't take it because I'm a good Christian, you know. I go to my PhD program, and I'm wanting to study the Gospels. But as a PhD student, you have to take whatever New Testament seminar is being offered in the semester, and there's only one. And there was a professor named Craig Keener that I really wanted to have on my dissertation committee. And so I was committed to taking whatever he offered. And so it was the first semester of my second year of my PhD program. I go to register for classes, and I pull up the schedule, and I said, you have got to be kidding me. Because what do you think the one course that they were offering that semester by the one professor that I knew I had to take, it was Revelation. And at that point, in all seriousness, I'm not sure I'd ever sat down and read through all 22 chapters in one reading in my life. I don't think I had. And I was a PhD student, you know. Never taught on it at church, even though I'd been in ministry. Just avoided the whole thing. So I didn't know what I was going to write on. I had no idea what I was going to write on. And in a PhD seminar, like, your grade depends on the one paper that you write over the... I was like, what am I going to do? And so I opened up, and any commentary you open up, one of the first things you'll see is that Revelation has the weirdest Greek of any Greek that's ever been written from the time of Homer down through the Middle Ages. And that just piqued my curiosity at what's going on with this. So I wrote my paper that semester on that topic, and when Craig Keener came in, there were 12 of us in the seminar, and he said, I'm handing out your papers. He said, everybody did fine, but there's two of you in here who the research, you need to keep going with this. Like, this is just the start of something that could be good. So I get my paper back, and I said, you've got to be kidding me. I can't get away from the book of Revelation, because he thought this was good research. And so I ended up deciding that I was going to write my dissertation on that topic, which means you have to take your comprehensive exams in that book, which means you have to know everything that's ever been said about the book in the history of since the book was written, and you have to know everything about the book. And so for 6 months, I had to completely, before my comps, I had to learn everything that there was to learn about the book of Revelation. And in those 6 months, I absolutely fell in love with the message of this book. And I'm actually convinced what I hope to convey to you this weekend is it is not as hard as we've made it. And when you get over the initial learning curve of what the book is doing and how it's doing it, it is so, the message is so encouraging and beautiful and uplifting. And it's nothing like what most Americans at least think the message of the book is. What I hope to say is something provocative right now that I'd like to show over the next weekend is this. I think the book of Revelation may have one of the most important messages for the church today. And it's a message that we've been neglecting. And so what I want to call us to is to engage, learn how the book works, to read it well, because this is a message that the church needs today. And I hope to do that. So that's me. The day that my author copies of my dissertation that was published came in, those are my cute kids. That's Anna and that's Jackson. And then now I actually, that's me on the right in, that is me in Perga in Turkey. And now my wife and I lead trips to Bible lands. And this past summer we actually led 45. We went to Turkey and Greece. We did a cruise on the Greek islands and visited sites that connected to Paul. But we went to all the seven churches, and this was our crew that we took with us. Kind of shameless plug here. I do have two lists out on the table out there. I'm under contract to write an introduction to the book of Revelation using the Roman coins thing that I'm going to make clear to you as we go through this presentation. If you're interested in this, you could sign up, and when it's published, I'll send you an email and just let you know. And then if you'd be interested in being on our interest list for these trips that we offer, we're doing biblical artifact museums this summer. Next summer, we're doing Israel, and then the following summer, we're going back to Turkey and Greece. And then the following summer, we'll do Egypt. And so it's our goal to help people go to these sites and experience these things. So I do have those two sign-up lists out in the foyer for you. So in other words, I've gone from avoiding the book my whole life to taking people, and we go to all of the seven sites and we worship. We read the message to the church and we pray and we think about, as we stand there, we think about how that message affected those people. The most important thing we can do whenever we come to any document of the New Testament is ask, what is its literary genre? If genre is a new word for you, it's a word that just means classifying a literary work based on its characteristics and the characteristics that it shares in common with other literary works. So, for example, I'm assuming you have these same genres here in Canada. When a book starts with Once Upon a Time, you know that you don't have to run around going, oh no, there's a dragon out to eat me, right? You know that you're reading something from a fictional genre, and so you know how to read that. We know just by that. And let me just ask you, the way that genre has trained you over the years, a book that begins Once Upon a Time is probably going to end with They Lived Happily. You know how to read that genre, right? Now, you're going to get in big trouble if you try to read that genre as a historical work. You're going to say, we got to go help that princess in that tower. There's a dragon trying to eat her. You know, if you go to the movies and you're expecting to see an action movie or a comedy and it ends up being a documentary, you're going to be sorely disappointed, right? These are genres. One of the most interesting stories is the Orson Welles War of the World, that's a tongue twister, 1898. 1938, they're reading this story. It's Halloween. They're reading this story over the radio. And millions, there have been psychologists who have tried to crunch the numbers on this. They estimate that 2 to 3 million Americans in 1938 believed that there were really aliens invading New Jersey. Like, really believe this was happening. So everybody's calling 911. The police end up having to storm the radio station and tell them, you've got to start announcing that you're reading War of the Worlds, which was a fictional film. And essentially what's happening is we're reading Revelation, and we don't know the genre, and so it's really scaring a lot of people, but we're not reading the genre well because we're not familiar with the genre. Does that make sense? It's a genre that you and I don't read regularly. We have not been trained how to read it, and so it's scaring the living daylights out of us as we read it. And we're worried that someone, essentially, what Revelation is doing is John is reading out over the radio a series of events that you need to be afraid about in the future, and so we're scared to death. And what I want to share with you over the course of our time together is how to understand the genre of Revelation. Now, when I say the genre of Revelation, I actually have to speak about three different genres. So it's a complex work that's made up of three different genres. It is at once an apocalypse, a prophecy, and a letter. And I want to work through these three with you for the rest of our time together tonight. And the reason this is so important is because these three parts of its genre tell us how the book is working. The fact that it is an apocalypse tells us how the book of Revelation works. The fact that it is a prophecy tells us what the book of Revelation is doing. And the fact that it is a letter tells us to whom the book of Revelation is doing this thing. And so it's really important to get all three of these. And it's actually the combination of all three of these that make it so hard for modern Canadians or Americans to read the book. Because all three of these are genres that we don't have or are used to reading. Now, we do read letters, but not letters written to first century people. And so this is what makes Revelation so challenging. We're going to start at the bottom and work our way back. First, Revelation is a letter, and it reminds us to whom this book is written. Now, when I say letter, I start here with Ephesians because Ephesus is one of the seven churches. We know that, right? So I start here with Ephesians and look at how Ephesians starts. So this is the Apostle Paul in the ancient world, just like I know to start my letter with Dear Mike. And when I finish it, I'm going to say sincerely, right? We have a format for writing letters. In the ancient world, there was a format. We have the author identify himself. He says to whom this is being written, to the city in which those folks are being written in. And then a standard greeting is actually grace and peace. That's one of the things that you say to people, grace and peace. That's a common ancient greeting. And then you have a blessing at the beginning. Standard letter writing format. This is what anybody in Ephesus would be expecting if they received a letter. Now I'm going to turn a slide and it's going to be the opening of Revelation. We have the one who's sending the message. We have the author, ultimately, Jesus Christ, through his servant John. John to the seven churches, his audience, and where they're located in Asia. Grace and peace. Do you see it? And then we have a blessing. Do you see it? This is a letter. It begins like a letter. It ends like a letter. And it's written to seven churches in Asia Minor. And he specifically says in verses 9 through 11, write in a book what you see and send it to the seven churches, Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. And then those seven churches get their own individual, I don't think that these are letters, they're not standalone letters. I call them oracles or messages, like a prophet would deliver an oracle to a city. These are like oracles that a prophet would deliver. And so he gives them these seven messages to these seven cities. And this is one of the things that makes Revelation so hard for us is that how many of you could tell me anything about Philadelphia in the first century? Anybody have some info about Philadelphia queued up? What about Sardis? What about Pergamum? Anybody got anything? Now, it's essential in communication to communicate in a way that your audience can understand. And so the message of Revelation is communicating to its audience in a way that they can understand, but it is totally lost on us who know nothing about the first century world of the audience. Does that make sense? This is one of the things that makes Revelation so difficult. We must understand that Revelation is a message to them before asking what it means for us. And this is one of the main problems of the book of Revelation. And this is what I say. What ends up happening, this is the main problem of so many of the modern readings, especially those left behind readings, is they open up to the book of Revelation and they read the book and they look to the future. And really what we ought to do to be understanding the text of Revelation is read the book and then look to the past and to the seven churches to which the message was written. It's the wrong orientation. Does that make sense, right? It's the wrong orientation to read the book. Many modern day readings are reading it as a message to us or to other future people when it's clearly designed to be a message to those seven churches. And that seems like such a basic observation, but we lose our minds when we sit down with all the Bible, but Revelation in particular, because we sit down with all the Bible and we say, we read a passage, what does this mean for me? What does this mean for us? What does this mean for America? What does this mean for Canada? And the book was designed for those seven churches. So one of the things I have to try to work on my students all semester long is we'll read a passage and we'll start talking about it, and they want to start talking about me and my and I and we. And I say, wait. If your reading wouldn't make sense to somebody sitting in the pews in Pergamum, it's not right. In other words, the book of Revelation is not about Donald Trump. It's not about Barack Obama. It's not about these politicians. If it wouldn't make sense to somebody in Philadelphia, it's not right. And that's a great litmus test to use to read the book of Revelation. So that's number one. It's a letter to those seven churches. Don't lose that. Number two, it's a prophecy. If John were here today and you were to ask John, what is the genre of this book? I think John would say it's a prophet. It's a prophecy. In fact, repeatedly throughout the book, he refers to the words of Revelation as prophecy. Words of the prophecy of this book. The words of the prophecy of this book. The words of the prophecy of this book. All through, this is what it's called. John refers to himself in this book. In 22:9, he says, I'm a fellow servant with the prophets. Whichever John this is, and there are multiple famous Johns in the first century, early Christians say it's John 1 of the 12. I just want you to know that Revelation itself doesn't say that. Early Christianity says it's John, son of Zebedee, one of the 12. And I'm fine with that. But Revelation doesn't say that. It just says John. Can you think of some other important Johns in early Christianity? Several of them, right? And so, or it could be a John that's maybe not even one of those famous ones. The author identifies himself as John, and he says he's working with a group of prophets who are traveling in Asia Minor. And so, he is in a prophetic circle. He is using the verb prophesy. John would say, what I've written is a prophet, and the author John understands himself to be a prophet. So that naturally raises the question, what is prophecy? And I've almost never, I don't want to embarrass anybody, but I've almost never asked this question in a church or in class, and I didn't get this answer. Prophecy is telling the future. And what I want to say to that is, here's how we know this, because we have a lot of prophets in the Old Testament. These are John's models. In fact, one of the things that is one of the most interesting things about the book of Revelation is if I could take it and wring the book of Revelation out right now, the Old Testament would just come pouring out. In fact, in the book of Revelation, one of the things that makes it unique is it never quotes the Old Testament, but it alludes to it everywhere. And allusions are harder to tell than quotations. And so the estimates range between 300 and 600 allusions to the Old Testament in the book of Revelation. Now do the math on 22 chapters on that. Every word, every verse somehow alludes to the Old Testament. In fact, one of the things that I hope to have you trained to do by the end of our time together is whenever we study something tomorrow or the rest of tonight and I say, where do you think this comes from? Everybody in the room should know to say, the Old Testament. And then when I say, okay, where in the Old Testament? Then you get a little clammy at that point. And that's okay. you at least know Old Testament. And that's actually important because that's one of the learning hurdles of the book, is most of the strange stuff in Revelation, Revelation didn't make it strange. Revelation's just taking the strange stuff that's already in the Old Testament, actually. That's one of the things we haven't realized. But John loves these prophets. And when you read the prophets of the Old Testament, how much of what they do is future telling? Some. But mostly what the prophets are doing is going to Israel or her neighbors, the other nations like Assyria and Babylon, and saying, stop it! The prophets go to Israel and say, quit! What are you doing? In other words, they're going and judging the people on behalf of God, but they don't just end in judgment or negativity. They also offer hope. Let me tell you one of the prophets. I just taught this in class this week. Jonah. You read Jonah lately? How much of the book of Jonah is future telling? But how much of the book of Jonah is forth telling? What I mean by that is speaking truth to power on behalf of God. Does that make sense? Prophets in the Old Testament may have elements of future telling embedded within their message. In other words, if you do not repent, you will be overthrown. There's a future element to that prophecy. You will be overthrown. But they're not all just making detailed future predictions about what's going to happen in the future. Does that make sense? They are forth-telling on behalf of God, and most of them are speaking truth to power. The prophet that John loves the most is the prophet Ezekiel. If you didn't know this, the entire book of Revelation is structured after the prophet Ezekiel. Look at this. And if you want to complain that Revelation is long, it could be more than twice as long as it is. Ezekiel's a long prophet, and John has actually structured the entirety of the book of Revelation after Ezekiel. John is saying, I am prophet, I'm Ezekiel 2.0. And just like Ezekiel went to speak to the exiles who were under an oppressive foreign power, I am coming to speak to the exiles who are under a foreign oppressive power. And the same thing that Ezekiel saw, I have seen, and the same message that Ezekiel had for them, I have for you. This is how he presents the message in the book of Revelation. Now, the enemy of God's people in the Old Testament, the major one, is Babylon. They're the ones who destroy the Jerusalem and the temple in 586 BC. They are the enemy of God's people in the Old Testament. They take up huge portions of the Old Testament. And look at this. Revelation 14:8. Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. Where do you think that comes from? Thank you. What great students. A's already. Look at this. Isaiah 21:9. Fallen, fallen is Babylon. This comes straight from the Old Testament. This is Revelation 16. The great city Babylon. Babylon the Great. Revelation 17. 18. Babylon the Great. 18. Great city. Babylon the mighty city. Babylon. In other words, Revelation is going at Babylon pretty hard. There's just one problem. Babylon's been gone for 600 years. Babylon was destroyed by the Persians in 539. The major enemy of the people of God in Revelation is Babylon, but Babylon hadn't been around in six centuries. You follow me? What's going on here? What is Revelation doing by judging a nation that's been gone for 600 years? It's not even around. Well, the answer is, let's look at the characteristics of who Babylon is to the prophets of the Old Testament. It's the most powerful nation in the ancient world. It's the enemy of God's people. The Babylonian kings encouraged people to idolatry and to worship the kings, and the kings of Babylon required worship. Think about Daniel, right? And the statue that was set up in Daniel. Do you remember that story? That's Babylon. And then the Babylonians came in and destroyed Jerusalem and the temple in 586 BC. Who is the major power over God's people that John is writing to in the seven churches in Asia Minor in the first century? It's Rome. Let's talk about characteristics of Rome. Most powerful nation in the first century, the enemy of God's people. Roman emperors encouraged idolatry and required people to worship them. That's called the imperial cult. And then Romans destroyed the Jerusalem and the temple in 70 AD. Do you see the comparison here? And this is one of those things where if we read other apocalypses that we're going to talk about in just a moment, There are many contemporary works to the writing of Revelation that refers to Rome as Babylon. In other words, if we were part of the seven churches and we see all of this talk about Babylon, we would know immediately what it's talking about because we understand the genre. You with me? It's a critique of Rome. And Rome is acting like Babylon. And so as they're reading Babylon, they understand that he's talking about New Rome. And so in the same way that God's prophets went to God's people in the past and said, I know you're in exile. I know the Babylonians have destroyed you. Hold on. Keep your faith in God. John is showing up in the voice of an Ezekiel or an Isaiah, and he's telling God's people, I know you're in the shadow of Rome, but hold on. Keep going. Don't give in. Keep the faith. You with me? He's a prophet. And that brings us to our last of the genres, and that is apocalypse. And if, of these three, I would say that this is probably the most important one. For a modern person who's struggling to read the book, this is the one that gets people, that is so difficult because it is so unlike any genre that we are used to reading. In fact, there's only one other section, like larger section, in the entire Bible that we would say, there are some little ones, like Isaiah 24 and 25 is like a mini apocalypse. Jesus actually has some stuff in Matthew 24 that's kind of like an apocalypse. But the largest sustained section outside the book of Revelation is Daniel 7 through 12. And like, don't you love the lion's den stuff? You know, we love the fiery furnace with Azariah, Mishael, and Hananiah. Now, can I go on a little tangent here for 1 second? Sometimes you got to go on little tangents. It's the Saskatoon berry pie. I think those three guys, by the way, would be mortified that we call them Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Those are their Babylonian names. And they embed the Babylonian gods within them. Those guys would be mortified that we call them by that. They would want to be called Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael. Because those names have the name of God within them. So that's the only section. We like the fiery furnace. We like the lion's den. Now, can anybody tell me one thing from chapter 7 through 12? We don't know what to do with that because it is weird. It's an apocalypse. It's an apocalypse. Revelation is part of this ancient genre called apocalyptic literature. The word for the genre that modern scholars use to refer to it as an apocalypse or apocalyptic genre, they actually get from the first word of the book of Revelation. Have you ever heard of Revelation called the apocalypse? The very first Greek word of the book of Revelation is apokalypsis, Jesu Christu, the apocalypse of Jesus Christ. Now, the word apocalypse, all that the word apocalypse actually means is unveiling or revealing or uncovering something that was previously unknown. And so I can show you an apocalypse really quickly. You ready? There you go. You just saw an apocalypse. If something is hidden from you and then it is revealed, that's an apocalypse. And what the book of Revelation is doing as a work in the apocalyptic genre is what God is doing is sharing with you information about what's happening in the heavenly realm and the earthly realm, that if you were just living on the earth, you wouldn't see it. And so what the apocalypse does is it like pulls the curtain back so you get to see behind the scenes. Does that make sense? That's what the whole book is doing, is it's pulling the curtain back so that you can see the world in which you live clearly. That's what all the apocalypses do. It's a revealing or an unveiling. And that's why it's translated into English as the revelation of Jesus Christ. The Greek word is just the apocalypse of Jesus Christ. In other words, the word apocalypse is not synonymous with the end times. We call movie genres, we say this is apocalyptic, and by that we mean, you know, the end times. That's not what that word means. That's come to be a modern kind of cultural meaning of that word, but it's not here. It just means to reveal something. And this is the most important thing I think I can share with you if you didn't know this. From about 200 BC to about 200 AD, so Revelation sits kind of right in the middle of that time frame, we have about 37 known works that are categorized as apocalypses that have survived down to today. And that's an amazing thing to say because you realize that almost everything that was ever written in the course of human history has been lost. Right? All of it's written on paper that just doesn't survive 2,000 years of history. So almost everything that's ever been written in human history is lost. And so when, in 2025, we know that there are 37 different apocalypses, and it wasn't even just Jews who liked this, Christians like this. In fact, Shepherd of Hermas was one of the most beloved Christian texts. And when you talk about books that almost made it into the 27 books of the New Testament, Shepherd of Hermas is up there. They loved apocalypses. That means that ancient people knew how to read these and they loved them. How many of these have you ever read? So here's what a nerd like me does. If I want to understand Revelation as an apocalypse, I need to go read these other ones and figure out how apocalypses work so then I can understand how Revelation works. Does that make sense? And when you read apocalypses, here are some things that you find out. And John actually tells us this in this little, we don't pick up on these little things, but when he says he made it known, the Greek word here is he signified it. This is the word that we get signs. You know, in the Gospel of John, Jesus doesn't do miracles, he does signs. Do you know that? And a sign is something that points beyond itself to some other reality. A sign points to something else. And so he says at the very beginning here, the revelation is going to work by showing you signs, which are things that point to other realities. And so whenever you encounter a vision in the book of Revelation, you need to be asking, to what reality does this image or this vision point? What is it signifying or pointing to? So let me give you some examples. There are a few times where John breaks in and actually tells us how to understand the signs. And in these few instances, we say, thank you, John. Couldn't you have done this the whole way through, please? You know. But let me show you some examples. Right here in chapter 1, he says, I saw seven golden lampstands. And then 7 verses later, he says, as for the mystery, the 7 lampstands are the 7 churches. Do you see that? He's giving you a clue how to read the signs of the book of Revelation. When you see a sign, the 7 lampstands are always 7 churches. Now, can you stick with this? It's going to be really important for the sermon Sunday. So for the people who didn't show up on Friday night for the seminar, when I ask in the sermon, what do 7 lampstands represent? Everybody's going to go, the churches! And everybody's going to be like, whoa, scholars in the room. You know, had no idea. But this is just one example. Now, we wish John did this for everything, but he only does this a couple of times. In his right hand, he held 7 stars. And he says, as for the mystery of the 7 stars that were in my right hand and the 7 golden lampstands, the 7 stars are the angels of the churches. You see how he's explaining this. Now, the hard thing is you need to do this with every image in the whole book. What is this reality referring to? And it has to be something in the audience of the 7 churches that they could or would understand. In other words, the 7 stars are not Black Hawk helicopters. You with me? These 3 genres work together. They have to make sense. Here's another one later in chapter 17. He's talking about the woman being on a beast with 7 heads. And this one's actually really, really important. And he says this woman's on a beast with 7 heads. And as for the mystery of the 7 heads, and then verse 9 he says, this calls for a mind of wisdom. This is John's way of saying, lean in and listen. I'm about to tell you something really important. I need you to use your wisdom right now. The 7 heads that the woman is seated on are 7 mountains on which she's seated. Do you see that? The 7 heads of the beast are 7 mountains on which the woman is seated. Now, has anybody ever heard Rome called the city set on? Do you see it? The audience would have understood. This is a reference to Rome. And the beast is Rome. Do you see it? You with me? There's a learning curve, but when you see it, it's not that hard. Now, one of the niche things that I do in my presentations, and this is why I'm saying the book that I'm writing is on this, is so much of what Revelation is doing is going at the images that would have been so common to the people in the first century world, but which we've lost. We don't know these images. We don't know these 7 churches. So much of it is going against the message of empire, the message of Rome. Well, what is one of the places that you see Rome's messages the clearest? And it's on coins. In the ancient world, coins were the way that the emperors would disseminate their propaganda to the empire. Everybody had to use them to pay taxes. And the other thing is, most people in the ancient world, they could not read. So the way that the emperors would communicate is through the use of images. Can I show you one? This is the woman seated on seven hills. But everyone would have known whom the woman was. In Rome, it is the goddess Roma. She is the goddess who is empowering the Roman state. And here she is, in their pockets, on their money, seated on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, because everyone knows that Rome is the city set on seven hills. And Revelation comes in and lampoons this image and says, she is not a deified goddess whom you ought to worship. She is a bloodthirsty prostitute who is drunk on the blood of the martyrs. Might this challenge you if you're tempted to worship Rome? Do you see it? It's really powerful. And Revelation is subverting these kind of images and saying the image that Rome wants you to see of a goddess seated on the seven hills empowering the state, she got to this position because she's martyring the Christians. She's drunk on their blood. She's sleeping with all the kings of the earth. She's doing whatever she can for the economics of the empire. She's exploiting people. She's hurting people. Don't go worship that woman. I like coins. Apocalypses in the ancient world, all those 37 that I mentioned to you, they communicate through symbols and images. They use ancient myths. They use animals and colors and numbers and symbols that would be understood because they refer to everyday entities. Revelation, most of the images are taken from the Old Testament. It's the language of John. It's the language of the audience. And others come from the world of the seven churches. And so the better question to ask is, whenever you read any image in the book, is to what reality or truth does this symbol point? Have you ever noticed these frog spirits? You notice these horrifying frogs that are in Revelation 16? You know, for all the people who are worried about 666 being on their tax documents, I've never known anybody worried about evil frog spirits out to get them. We're selectively, you know, we cherry pick the things out of Revelation that this is horrifying, isn't it? The frog spirit. Well, let me ask you this. As you read the bowls of judgment and people experience painful sores, water turning into blood, fire coming from the sun, darkness, parting of the waters for kings to cross, and frogs, and they're called plagues, does this make you reminiscent of anything? This is the Exodus. In other words, do you see what we're doing? People are reading the book of Revelation and say, we got to be worried about frogs. When the book of Revelation is referring to the Old Testament, the Exodus. And what you find in the book of Exodus, by the way, is that the plagues, I just taught through these in class, the plagues, as judgment and as violent as they are, they're actually an unbelievable act of grace. How many chances does God give Pharaoh and the Egyptians? 10? I don't give my kids that many chances. Maybe 2 if they're lucky. 3 and their life's on the line. Revelation gives them... The Exodus gives them 10 chances? That's grace, is it not? In the book of Revelation, there's the judgments of the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls. Let's do our math here. There's 7 in each of those. That's 21. That's 2 times the amount of grace that the Pharaoh received, plus 1 more for good measure. We've tended to read these as these terrible judgments, when if you read them through the lens of the Old Testament, they're actually acts of grace. What was the purpose, by the way, of the Exodus? To let God's people go and to stop the evil, oppressive empire of the Egyptians from hurting and enslaving God's people. What is John trying to get the Roman Empire to get the Christians to understand themselves? They're persecuted in the shadow of a major oppressive empire. Do you see it? Revelation's using the Old Testament. How about those locust scorpion horses? You ever been worried about these? Where do you think these come from, by the way? Okay, 2 of you get A's. They do. They do. In Revelation 9, just look at what's said here. They're like locusts, like horses equipped for battle. Their teeth like lion's teeth. Many chariots rushing into battle. They're called Abaddon in Hebrew, which is Apollyon in Greek, the destroyer. This is from Joel. We've got locusts, lion's teeth. In other words, all the weird stuff, it's in the Old Testament first. Can I tell you why Revelation's hard for us? We don't know our Old Testaments. Joel made it weird before John did. We've just never read Joel. They have the appearance of horses. These are those locust creatures. They're like horses ready to charge. They're powerful. They're drawn up for battle, and they're called the destroyer. Everything in these weird visions of Revelation, they come from the Old Testament. But the key problem for us is that, number one, we don't know our Old Testament. But then when it comes to the symbolic world of the audience, these first century people, we don't share that symbolic world that would have been so obvious to them. So what I did a couple of years ago to teach at churches, what I was inspired by the book of Revelation to write this thing that would hopefully show an American audience what I'm talking about. Because in America, we have all of these symbolic things that are in our world that if I just say red, white, and blue, everybody knows exactly what I'm talking about. So your incredible minister here, Mike, who you don't pay enough. I don't know what he makes. I'm just kidding. But he had to check me out because he knew, invited a Revelation guy, and yeah, we got to see. So he watched this and saw what I did, and he wrote one for you. So I don't know how this is going to go, Mike, but we're about to find out. But what if this were written to you? I saw a beast with the head of a polar bear, the body of a caribou, the tail of a beaver, and the wings of a loon standing beneath a large maple tree on the shores of Rideau Canal. Is that right? Did I say that right? Then I heard a loud voice, and I looked, and behold, I saw a rider coming from the Queen City, wearing a red coat and a flat-brimmed felt hat. He approached a man standing near a frozen pond with the number 99 branded on his back, and announced, "Behold, for your sins I'm bringing upon you earthquakes, wildfires, floods, and tornadoes for your participation in the selling and buying of human souls. You have allowed the beast with three heads to plunder the nations, and behold, after 1,867 days, I saw a man with one leg crossing the nation and bringing hope. And behold, then I heard the voice of 10 seraphim and 3 cherubim crying out in worship to God and the Lamb, 'This land is your land. This is the Lamb's land. From Bonavista to Vancouver Island, from the Arctic Circle to the Great Lake waters, God keep this land glorious and free. O Lion and Lamb, we stand in awe of Thee.'" Good. I take it from your last laughter that you understood the symbolic world. Now, the illustration of this is to say that the people in the seven churches of Revelation would hear Revelation this way. They would hear Revelation this way. When it speaks about a woman seated on seven hills, they would know immediately what that is. The numbers, the colors, the symbols, the Old Testament imagery, they would get this stuff immediately. You with me? What, by the way, is the main critique in here, the judgment? Do you notice it? The buying and selling of human souls? Every line of this, I took inspiration from Revelation. And if you didn't know this, in Revelation 18, verses 11 to 13, there's one of the most interesting things in all the New Testament. There's nothing like it elsewhere. It's a critique of the Roman commercial economy, and it's a list of 26 commercial goods that were bought and sold over the Roman Empire. And the last element of that is the buying and selling of human souls. There's a critique of the slave trade in the Roman Empire in the book of Revelation. And so when I use that, that's actually here in the book of Revelation. The last thing is, do you notice the song? Did you pick up on the song? Mike introed the songs that we sang this way, but do you know in the book of Revelation there's 15 hymns? It's the book, besides the Psalms, that's inspired more of our songs and our hymns than any other book in the Bible. Now, I have a theory on that. And I'll share my theory with you, and there's no way that I'll ever know that I'm right. One of the things that Revelation is really trying to go at is trying to get Christians who are tempted to worship the emperor and the empire to make sure that they don't get their worship misplaced away from the right one on the right throne. That's what Revelation's really about. Come tomorrow and we'll work that out. But one of the things that we know that the emperors had in the ancient world was they had this group called the Hymnodes that were specifically operating in Asia Minor, where these seven churches are. We found inscriptions to the Hymnodes where it literally tells us like what the altos and sopranos were paid. I kid you not. Like, we know exactly what they were paid, this traveling choir, and they would travel around to the seven churches amongst the other churches of Asia Minor, and they would sing to the emperor on these holidays. And my suspicion is, and I'll never know if I'm fully right, that many of the hymns in the book of Revelation are taking songs that they would have sang to the emperor and substituting it with the proper one who's due that worship. It's reorienting their worship away from empire to the true one on the throne. And they would have known these hymns. They would have known these songs. They would have known these images in the same way that, Mike, this went over better than I could have thought. Thank you for doing that. The genre that I think is the closest to the book of Revelation is political cartoon. So in America, if I say, are you of the elephant or the donkey? People know what that means. You're Republican or Democrat. They know immediately what that means. A lot of Americans have started to say, I'm of the lamb. Political cartoons have been used through all of history. And they've displayed their opponents as being dragons and things like that. I think that's one of the best ways. And so in a political cartoon, whenever you read it, you're not worried that it's really a donkey or an elephant. You know exactly what it symbolizes. This is how we need to read the book of Revelation. What about this? Is this in your symbolic world? You know, Mike told me about this earlier, so thought I'd give it a try. The 77 Sundays you spent looking for a rubber duck? This message is not just for Canadians. This is specific for this congregation. And it's something that only you understand. And so what we need to do a responsible reading of the book of Revelation is we need to remember that it's three different genres, and your reading of Revelation needs to take into account it's a letter written to those seven churches. And when we understand it as a message first to them, then we can understand it as a message to us. It is a prophecy, and what it's doing is drawing on the language of the prophets of the Old Testament to speak truth to power, to tell the empire, you are overstepping your bounds. To tell the emperor, you are overstepping your bounds and you are asking for a kind of worship that only properly belongs to God. That's what prophecy does. And by the way, if you tie your cart to the imperial horse, whether that's Assyria or Babylon or Egypt or Rome or America or Canada or any other nation, if you tie your cart to that horse, you have tied your cart to the wrong thing. Because there is only one person who is on the throne. There is only one person to whom our allegiance and our worship is due, and that is God and the Lamb. That's the message of the book of Revelation. And that's what prophets are trying to tell Israel. And that's what John's trying to tell Christians in his day. And then lastly, it's an apocalypse. And so the way that it shares that message is through signs and symbols and colors and Old Testament images. And we need to read it asking, to what does this symbol point? Come back tomorrow, and we're going to dive into the seven churches and the messages to those seven churches and how those messages help us understand the rest of the book. Thank you so much for an awesome night. Appreciate it.